This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
We focus on the part of the internet that most people don't know about. It's called the dark web.
Undercover in the furthest corners of the dark web, US special agents are on a mission to locate and rescue children from abuse.
Move in now.
Police!
From the BBC World Service, World of Secrets, the darkest web follows their shocking investigations. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Productivity isn't everything, the Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman once wrote, but in the long run, it's almost everything. At the end of the month, the Chancellor Rachel Rees will present her budget, and some of the biggest decisions would have been framed by forecasts of the UK economy's productivity. She herself has talked about the pressing need to improve it. But what exactly is productivity? Why is ours so low? And what do we need to do to improve it? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, what is it and why does it matter? I'm joined by Chris Giles, economics commentator at the Financial Times. Chris Giles, how do we define productivity? What is it?
Well, it's basically what we get out for what we put in. So how much stuff is produced, and that includes goods and services for the amount of labour, amount of capital, that's equipment, machinery, buildings, and then how it all gets mixed together. So the more you can get out for the number of people, the machines you've got, then that means you're going to be making more money, you're going to be richer, and you're going to have a higher standard of living.
Now, do we measure this in terms of how much money we make for what you'd put in?
It's essentially ultimately a measure of the value added, which is the amount that you produce, but that does turn into a number in pounds. So it is ultimately a monetary value. So it is how much are you producing as an individual for 1 hour of work?
In monetary value.
In monetary value, which is not just because you've bought something in, it's what are you personally contributing to the economy.
Now, I can see quite easily how you could measure what a factory does in the terms that you mentioned, but what about, I don't know, people working in management consultancy, how do we measure their productivity?
Well, ultimately, we try and measure the output of the management consultancy, and we measure essentially the input costs, which is how much they pay the staff. And then the productivity is the difference between the two. What gets really difficult is when, let's say that what they sell goes up a lot 1 year, how do you know whether that's because they've just put their prices up, in which case they're no more productive at all, they've just got market power, let's say, or because they've actually become more efficient and they're doing a much better job? It gets really difficult in these sorts of things.
Let's talk about some of the variables in the private sector. Americans, for example, famously hardly take any holidays at all. We take more, and some other countries take even more than we do. Would you improve your productivity, for instance, if you just dropped the number of holidays because you'd be getting more working days out of the same pay for people?
So if you had the same output but more working days, then that means productivity would have gone down because its output per hour is the core measure of labour productivity. But if those extra hours were then really productive, then you might get more. So it depends on exactly what's happening on both sides of how much labour is going in and how much are you getting out of it. And this is why you look at countries like Germany, which takes a lot of holidays. They really value their holidays. And they're very productive, but ultimately their income per head is a bit lower. But that's basically a choice. But in the hours they work, they're very productive.
Let's get out of the private sector for a moment and talk about the public sector. Do we measure productivity in the public sector, and is it the same?
We try in the UK and measure it in quite a smart way. Let's take health, for example. We measure the amount of visits to GPs, because that's something you can count, the amount of operation, the amount of procedures. And that is something that the UK does. And it's not quite alone in the world doing it that way, but it's unusual in the world and more advanced than lots of the ways that other countries do it.
So I suppose my next question is, should they actually be mixed in with private economic statistics? In other words, is it actually giving you a meaningful measure of the productivity of the nation to include public sector productivity?
I think you want to have both. You want to look at things that are the whole economy, so the whole of Britain together, and then sometimes just look at the market sector, so things where there's a proper market and prices and things where it's much easier to be confident that the statistics are measuring what you want them to measure. But you want to look at both.
Since we're coming up to a budget period, why does productivity and measuring productivity matter to a chancellor framing a budget?
The key thing about productivity is in the long term, what happens to productivity is pretty much everything in how prosperous a country will be. Because if you think about the very broad definition of what you get out for what you put in, if we have 30 million people roughly working in the UK, the more we get out of them, the richer we are as a society, the better off, the happier people will be because they've got more money, but also the more tax that will be paid and the more the government can then do with that taxation. So it is ultimately the most important thing for determining not only what's happened over the past 10, 15 years, but also for the forecast. So this is the crucial thing in the forecast, which tells you how much the economy can grow. And if the people doing the forecast have a very different view or change their view on productivity, that is the thing that affects the public finances more than anything else.
How do we compare in productivity with the rest of Europe and the United States?
The UK tends to perform a little bit poorly on labour productivity. So we are 80% of the US. So that means that a US person on average who works 4 days, it takes a UK person to work 5 days to produce the same amount of stuff. We are 85% of Germany and we're 90% of France. So we're behind all these big economies. We'd like to be up there with them. That's been very long-standing that we've had this difficult level of productivity relative to other countries. Between about 1979 and 2007, we were catching up with other similar countries. And after 2007, after the global financial crisis, we've fallen back a bit.
Let's look, let's say, at France. If we were to dig in a bit to their productivity levels, how much their workers produce, why would that be so different?
There are two reasons why it's different. One is they're just, in some sense, better than our workers, that they produce more, they may be trained better, they may have more capital, they may have better machinery that they're working with, and so they produce more per hour. And then there's a statistical reason, which is that France also has higher unemployment than the UK. So maybe their society has taken a choice where they'll have people working 0 hours and so they're not counted in these productivity statistics. Well, we'll have some quite low productivity workers, which we think is a better way of running society. And then that's really not something important. That's just a different choice, but it does show up in the statistics.
Chris Giles. And before we move on, a reminder about the Briefing Room podcast. If you visit BBC Sounds, you can find the entire back catalogue, such as the one which asks why there's a US military build-up off the Venezuelan coast, and the one which asks whether there's going to be a global financial market crash anytime soon.
We focus on the part of the internet that most people don't know about. It's called the dark web.
Undercover in the furthest corners of the dark web, US special agents are on a mission to locate and rescue children from abuse.
Move in now.
Police. From the BBC World Service, World of Secrets, The Darkest Web follows their shocking investigations. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now, back to productivity. Why ours is a problem and what to do about it. I'm joined by Helen Miller, Director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, Duncan Weldon, economist and author, and Greg Thwaites, who's research director at the Resolution Foundation. Helen, if I can start with you, what are the reasons for the UK's low productivity?
Well, I think maybe it's worth remembering that productivity is still growing. We're just not growing as fast as we were historically, and it's not growing as fast as in some other countries. And I think there's no one single factor that drives those two things. You can point to some specific factors that happen, some instances like leaving the single market of the European Union or the financial crisis that have pulled on productivity, and some longer term factors, one of which I would highlight as being underinvestment in machines and capital.
Duncan, we just heard from Helen that key moments are Brexit, also the financial crash of 2008. Why would either of those lower your productivity?
Well, we have had this series of really big shocks over the last 15 years. You know, the financial crisis in 2008-9, Brexit, referendum in 2016, pandemic in 2020, huge energy price shock after Russia invaded Ukraine. And, you know, starting with the financial crisis, you know, I mean, all of the evidence suggests that after a big financial crisis, the banking system is quite impaired. It struggles to make as many loans as it used to. That, you know, evidence suggests will have a lingering impact on productivity.
And not because companies can't borrow to invest.
Companies can't borrow to invest in the same way. Investment is lower. You know, financial services are very important to the United Kingdom's economy. And so there are plenty of reasons to expect that a global financial crisis might hit countries like the UK harder than some of our peers. You know, what's happened after Brexit is, you know, there are now new frictions, new trade barriers between the United Kingdom and our biggest trading partner. And what most economists would tell you is, if you put frictions into a previously mostly frictionless trading environment, there will be less trade. And all things being equal, to use an economist's favourite phrase, you know, less trade tends to mean slower productivity growth. Because when there's more trade, British firms are facing more competition. Because of their competition, they've got to innovate more, they've got to find better ways of doing things. And when there's less trade, there's less competitive pressure.
And we've seen less trade, have we?
We've seen, yeah, less trade than there would have been had we not left Europe's single market.
And Greg, can you talk us through some of those aspects of lower investment and particularly where and in what sectors and what places that happens?
Investment's important for productivity because it means that workers have better equipment to do their jobs with. They may have better patents or software, all kinds of intangible capital that you can't see or put in a box, as well as things like buildings and machines. So the more that workers have of that, the better. And it roughly explains all of the productivity difference with France. So French workers are much better equipped and they have better roads, for example. And so their HGV drivers are going to be sitting in less traffic and delivering more goods per hour. So that's why investment is important. And the UK's got a long history of investing less than our international peers, maybe 1 or 2 percentage points of GDP.
Do we see differences between different areas of the country in terms of their productivity growth?
Yes, we do. So the level of productivity is much higher in London than it is on average in the rest of the UK, but it's actually been growing a little bit less quickly. It looks like Manchester is actually starting to catch up with London, although it's got a long way to go. And the UK has very big gaps in productivity between different parts of the country. If you look at a country like Germany, there are lots of medium-sized cities which are very productive. Even if you look at France, which in many ways is similar to the UK, it's like a 1,000 years old, it's got a very big dominant capital. Its second cities, your Marseilles and your Lyons, are closer to Paris in productivity than Birmingham or Manchester would be to London. And I think that's got something to do with how we've handled or mishandled deindustrialization in the UK. So you don't have to go back very far to like maybe the 50s or the 60s, and the West Midlands would have been comparably as productive as the richest parts of the country, and even overheating to the point where the government would put special taxes on development in the West Midlands to try and slow it down, which seems like a crazy idea now, doesn't it?
Yes, I remember doing a programme on regional development and hearing that fact and finding it absolutely astonishing. Let's talk about which industries have particularly good and bad productivity levels, Helen.
Again, it depends a bit on how you're measuring productivity, but in the UK, we have a financial services sector that we heard is very productive. Think about the public sector, actually, we have a higher education system that is very productive. We are good at taking money and churning out high-skilled graduates.
If it's a measure of partially of income, in other words, how much income the universities get in, as opposed to how many people they actually educate, which is it? Because I can see that the more, let's say, foreign students you take in, the more income you get in, the more productive you could be said to be.
I mean, what you don't want to be saying is that we get more income and therefore we're more productive. That's not a real thing in some sense. But if you look at things like the level of like how skilled the people who come out of our system are, or the jobs they go on to have, or how much basic research we do, how many patents are created, we tend to be a place where we have lots of that kind of activity. So some parts of our public sector are quite productive. There are other parts that are very unproductive, and obviously, on average, usually the public sector is less productive than the private sector. We also have some bits of other industries that do, but some parts of high-end manufacturing do quite well. So I think it's a bit of a mixed picture, but the UK, I think, stands out particularly in its bits of its service sector.
Duncan, how would you answer the same question?
I think there's a couple of big industries in the UK, which have previously contributed a lot to our productivity growth, which haven't had a great 15, 20 years, maybe as much for luck as any other reason. So one would be offshore oil and gas, you know, the North Sea oil fields. Now, getting that stuff out of the North Sea, you know, it's not particularly great for the climate, but it's very, very high productivity work, getting this very expensive stuff out of the sea with not very many workers. And, you know, for geological reasons as much as anything else, that industry has been in decline since really the turn of the millennium, and that does have an impact on our numbers. Pharmaceuticals and life sciences as well, traditionally a big driver of productivity growth in the 90s, early 2000s. The British pharmaceutical sector hasn't had a great 15 years. It hasn't had big breakthrough drugs in the way it did in the 80s and 90s. And that, again, might be just bad luck. We haven't had those big breakthrough drugs.
Why would that have an impact on productivity? I mean, they're still making lots of drugs.
They are, but if you have one of these weight loss drugs, which the Danes have had a breakthrough with, you know, you can suddenly sell this thing internationally for huge amounts of money in the short run. You know, your profits soar, your workforce isn't increasing, you know, output per worker, profits per worker, gross value add per worker, all of these things start to go up. Having these big sort of breakthrough blockbuster drugs can have an impact. There's another way to think about this sort of sector picture as well. Think of what you might think of as a compositional effect. A larger share of our economy nowadays seems to be devoted to relatively low productivity sectors than in the past.
So Such as?
The example I would give would be the hospitality sector, where the share of the workforce working in hospitality, whether that's restaurants, bars, hotels, whatever, has risen from about 6% to about 8% of the workforce. Quite a big expansion. And, you know, I like the hospitality sector as many, as I'm sure other listeners do, but it's not particularly high value add, high productivity work.
Helen, what impact does infrastructure, rail and so on, have on productivity?
Better infrastructure, better connection of people and places will mean that we can combine our resources, whether the human resources and the capital and the firms together in ways that mean we can be more productive. I think it's an area where the UK stands out as not always having wonderful infrastructure. It takes us longer to drive around. Like Oxford and Cambridge being the classic example, it's really hard to get between Oxford and Cambridge and collaborate if you're in those two places. It's worth saying too, it's not just about road and rail. They're the kind of big obvious ones. It's also about things like broadband and connectivity and all the other things that to do with communications. It's about connecting people and places in the broadest possible sense.
What about things like housing and skills training?
Building more houses would directly improve growth because they are very valuable. We have fewer houses than people would like, and therefore you build a house, you've built a very valuable asset, people are willing to pay a high price for it. But it's also the case, if you have more houses and people are more able to move around, for example, for their jobs, then I'd expect people to be in better match to jobs and the higher productivity. So housing, I think, has that dual role. On the skills, it's not just about more skills, it's about having the right skills. So I say we have a university sector that's doing pretty well, but we have a further education system that, to my mind, looks actually very neglected. So it's about the whole range of skills for all different types of people and making sure that they're getting the skills they need for today's job market.
Greg, since we've moved on to the question of how we could boost productivity, what are your kind of key points?
So I think the thing to remember is that productivity is hugely dispersed within a sector or within a region. So as in any part of the country, there are some brilliant firms and some less brilliant ones. And the key thing is that those brilliant firms are the ones that are innovating, that are inventing new products, new ways of doing things. And that's where a lot of the growth comes from. And then what they need is they need to basically grow at the expense of the less productive firms. So we need to have a process of creative destruction. And that's about big firms growing at the expense of small ones. And politicians talk about protecting small businesses. And I'm going to say that we actually don't want to do that. We might want to protect young businesses, but not small businesses. Some small businesses need to die.
Okay, since you've been heretical, probably in Radio 4 terms, what do we currently do for small businesses that actually discourages productivity? What do we give them that we probably shouldn't?
We give them lower rates of corporation tax. We give them a pass on their first bits of employer national insurance. In some cases, we give them lower business rates. So it's kind of cheaper to be a small business than it is to be a big business. That means there's a tax on growth.
Right, okay. So that sounds very tough.
But the key point is that ultimately this will be good for everybody. There will be some short-term losers because there'll be some people going out of business. I know, you know, from my family how stressful that can be, but it's ultimately it's the last 200, 300 years of economic growth has been a period of creative destruction with new things and better things replacing old-fashioned ones that don't work so well anymore.
Duncan, what would you see as the things that we should or could do?
Lots of this is about getting fundamentals right, having a high and stable level of public investment, encouraging private sector investment, having the right skills policy, having a stable environment for business where they can plan for the medium to long term and make investments in skills and capital and machinery and all of that. It's worth emphasising, though, that all of these things take a long time. You know, there's no button the Chancellor can just press, which is increase productivity now. You know, I've sort of reminded that politicians tend to overestimate what they can achieve in the short run and sometimes underestimate what they can achieve in the long run. That, you know, real measures to increase British productivity now in the mid-2020s probably won't start to bear fruit until the early to mid-2030s.
Duncan, I want to go on to the one thing which people think will make a huge difference to productivity, but obviously not just here, which is the advent of AI. What role do we expect it to play?
So there is a huge range of estimates from different very eminent economists on what impact AI might have on a 5, 10, 15-year view on productivity, which vary from not very much at all to utterly transformational. Now, you know, I'm not well equipped to judge how the technology is developing. What I can say is that someone that's thought a lot about economic history over the years is that even really big breakthroughs in technology, such as the railways or telegrams or telephones or the internet, tend to take quite a long time to sort of diffuse throughout the whole economy. Yeah, I think the classic one for me right now would be the internet. You know, in the mid-1990s, an awful lot of hype about the internet, a lot of arguments the internet was going to utterly transform how our economy worked, of business. And, you know, 25, 30 years on, in many ways, it has. You know, there are whole new industries being created, industries destroyed, everyday life, society, the economy transformed. But we're talking about 15, 20 years of weak productivity growth. That's with the internet, with this major change. You can have a big change in how your economy works, driven by technology, without productivity soaring.
Helen.
Yeah, so I think my view is that nobody knows yet how the effect of AI will play out. Everyone's got their own favourite example of that. I work in research. I can see how some of the junior economists coming into research nowadays can create models in afternoons that would have taken me months to code 10 years ago. So there are obviously examples where it is making people more productive, but I don't think we know yet how widespread it will be. It's also the case that some of what AI is being used for is perfectly valid, but it's not productivity enhancing. If you're using AI to, I don't know, plan your dinner tonight, that's perfectly valid things to do, but that's not going to drive up the size of the economy necessarily. I also think importantly, we have some control over how this technology develops. So what we want to be thinking about in part is it going to be complementary to human beings? So we'll use it to make ourselves more productive. Or is it going to substitute for human beings? Is it going to actually displace some human work? And that isn't necessarily a bad thing. You might have humans stopping doing some things and starting doing other things. But I think as this technology develops, we need to keep an eye on that and mould it in such a way that it's working with us, for us, in the way that we want, and not just sort of sit and be victims to how this washes over the economy.
Greg, can we see situations actually in which you could have very low unemployment and still very high productivity?
Yes, so the optimistic case for low unemployment and high productivity, you could look at a country like the Netherlands, which has a much higher employment rate than the UK and is more productive, but the people there tend to work fewer hours on average. And that seems like a pretty good deal to me. And people live a much higher standard of living there than they do in the UK.
Why are they able to do that? Why is France does it the other way and they have higher levels of unemployment and greater productivity?
There are some really brilliant international companies in the Netherlands that provide lots of very good jobs. They've got different labour market institutions that don't encourage people to stay out of the labour force like they do in France. The Netherlands is quite a small country. And if you look at just like the richest bit of the UK, it's kind of comparable in a way. Like wages are very high in the southeast of England, and it's about the same size as the Netherlands. So it is possible. But what's amazing about the Netherlands is they managed to do it on a national scale.
So, Duncan, is there a kind of happy place where we can get to whereby we're all employed, but we're all more productive?
That's the dream, isn't it? You know, I'm a firm believer that, you know, what an economist might call a hot labour market, a market where there isn't much spare capacity in the economy. I think that's quite a good place for an economy to be. Not too hot, but
is
quite
that,
hot.
Is that, because enough, is that because it makes employers having to compete for labour also more likely to try and invest?
Yes, employers are competing for labour, so they're having to pay their workforce properly. They're having to find ways to innovate because there aren't just, you know, spare resources they can suck up. You get a rising living standards, a reasonably fast-growing economy. And when you've got that faster-growing economy, you know, the government's tax revenues look a bit healthier and we can have better public services too.
I think that brings us very neatly, Helen, to the question of the choices that Rachel Reeves has to make. She's citing lower productivity growth forecasts recently as one of the reasons she's going to have particularly difficult choices to make in the budget, which may mean tax rises or hikes in income tax. What's the IFS's view on this? What would the cost of lower productivity forecasts be?
Yeah. Well, it's worth reminding people basically what's happening here is that Rachel Reeves has a five-year forecast and she is, you know, has a guess of what does she think spending is going to be, what does she think revenue is going to be, and she wants those things to match in a certain amount of years' time. If productivity, if the forecast gets lower, and that's what we think is going to happen in the budget, and therefore you won't have as much revenue as you thought to pay for the services that you've promised, that's kind of what's happening. As a rule of thumb, you can think that every 0.1 percentage point decrease in expected productivity would cost the government something like £7 billion. You could easily see a situation where the Office of Budget Responsibility downgrades productivity by 0.2, 0.3, say, and Rachel Reeves would have £15 to £20 billion less than she might otherwise have thought she was going to have. And therefore, in that situation, you basically have to cut spending or you have to raise taxes. But small changes in the growth forecast productivity have a really big effect. They really affect how much revenue the government expects it's going to get.
And let's be clear, this is just the forecast. It's not a thing that's actually happened. It's the forecast that she then has to take a decision about, which could, you know, affect the country economically and also her politically. Greg, are there any glimmers of hope which we haven't really quite managed to get to here?
Yes, I think so. So we talked about the shocks that the economy has been hit by. It's been hit by Brexit. Now, maybe the impact of Brexit has kind of run its course. So it's been dragging down on growth before and it's going to stop dragging over the future. Another one is that, you know, this rise in the minimum wage that we've seen recently, the rise in energy prices, the rise in interest rates, maybe that's going to do the job of squeezing the less efficient firms out of business. And like I've said, that might be good for productivity in the long run. And then, yes, I think there are some decisions that the government's taken to do with investing in infrastructure that could be good for productivity in the long run.
Helen, are there any signs that growth is picking up? In other words, OK, so this next budget will be a bad one. Are there any signs that the budget after or the budget after that could be slightly better?
So I think there are some signs that growth is picking up. It's also the case that if we continue to see inflation stay under control, the Bank of England should reduce interest rates. That will also have a positive effect. So the economy can expand somewhat. I think the other reason for optimism is that policymakers can do things about this. There's absolutely no button in Treasury where you press it and you get productivity. But you can do the hard yards across many policy areas. So you could reform taxes, you could reform education and skills policy, you could reform competition policy, infrastructure. And you're not going to see those things necessarily play out in 2 years' time. But if you did enough of them, I think you could actually get the economy moving faster.
Duncan, reasons to be cheerful, part three.
I've got a lot of sympathy for Greg's calls for creative destruction, for this idea that the British economy has too many people in low productivity jobs, too many low productivity firms, and we'd be in a better place if those jobs were destroyed, if those firms went out of business and those resources were used somewhere else. Now, you know, Greg can say that on this programme. I don't think the Chancellor is going to come on the BBC and say, I want to destroy these unproductive small businesses. But the Chancellor might not be saying that, but the impact of the large rises we've seen in the minimum wage, of the increase we've seen in national insurance contributions by employers, you know, leads me to suspect that maybe the Chancellor agrees with Greg, even if she can't say it.
And that's all we've got time for. My thanks to Duncan Weldon, Helen Miller, Greg Thwaites and Chris Giles. And my conclusion? It doesn't really sound like the cavalry's going to arrive in time for Rachel Reeves. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey, Cordelia Hemming and Kirstine Knight. The sound engineers were Rod Farker and James Beard, and the editor was Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
I'm Ragnar O'Connor from BBC Radio 4 and the History Podcast. This is The Magnificent O'Connors. In war-torn London, a man is murdered. The police arrest 23-year-old Jimmy O'Connor. He's sentenced to death, but Jimmy is my dad. For 80 years, my family has fought to prove his innocence, and now we're making one final attempt to uncover the truth. But are we ready for what we'll find? The Magnificent O'Connors. Listen first on BBC Sounds.
We focus on the part of the internet that most people don't know about. It's called the dark web.
Undercover in the furthest corners of the dark web, US special agents are on a mission to locate and rescue children from abuse.
Move in now.
Police!
From the BBC World Service, World of Secrets, the darkest web follows their shocking investigations. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your BBC podcasts.